What I'm going to do for the next hour or so is go through about 10 what I call tips and tricks about Azure that I highly recommend to pretty much everyone. So hopefully none of them are sort of industry or scenario specific, but instead are kind of recommendations from what I've seen in terms of large real world projects and apply to both advanced scenarios as well as for people who are just getting started. The first one here is a, sort of probably the simplest trick that I actually came up with, and it's one that for a lot of people you take for granted, but you'd be surprised how many people I encounter that have no idea that this thing exists, which is the custom dashboard support that we have inside the Azure portal. And so I'll spend 2 minutes showing this one because it's a simple one, but it ends up being a big one for folks. How many people here have a single Azure dashboard? Good, okay, so half the people. How many people don't even know what an Azure dashboard is? A few people, they're new, okay. So basically my meta point is if you only have a single dashboard, you aren't using the portal right. That's maybe a strong statement, but one of the things that you can take advantage of that I recommend is think about creating a couple of custom views so that as you're working with Azure, you can very easily switch between those views depending on actually what you're doing. And it can help simplify your workflow, simplify your life. So, you know, as an example, here is the dashboard I've been doing this talk with. And, you know, it's got everything I'm sort of demoing in one place, which makes it convenient. You know, the thing that if I wanted to do, though, is if I click up here in the dashboard link, you'll notice there's many, many other dashboards that I have, some that I've created, some that my team has given me or shared with me that I can optionally use as well. And so the nice thing about dashboards is you can actually share them across a team environment. And for example, if I wanted to create a new dashboard, call it, you know, my dev workload, I could do that. I could then open up any resource that's specific to the project I'm working on. So it doesn't have to be my dev workload. It could be project foo that I'm working on. I could then go in. I could pin any resource. And so the thing to also keep in mind here in Azure, click the pin button. It pins it. Pin works not just on resources, but you can actually take any metric and pin that as well. And now I have a custom view. Again, I can customize and lay out this view in a variety of different ways. If I wanted to, I could make this small, I could make it big. Again, however you want. And then the nice thing is if this is my dev workload, and then suddenly someone calls me and says, hey, we're hearing customer reports of problems, or an alert comes in, which I'll talk about in the monitoring section later, I can quickly say, wait, what's going on? Drill into the specific view that I'm using for operations, and lay out all the graphs and all the charts specific to that view, or someone says, hey, that container service that we're having has a problem. Again, I can easily flip very quickly and pull up a heads-up display on top of everything to do with that container service, and I'm no longer hunting around with lots of resources trying to look stuff up. Instead, ideally, I have a view that's already created that has just the information I need. So think about it between dev and operations or project to project. Create the custom view with just the information that's relevant to you. Gives you a really fast way that you can switch between them and see everything in one place at one time. Other kind of quick thing that a lot of people don't know is the full screen option. Click the full screen option and it goes full screen. The thing that this is useful is if you're in a team environment, we sort of built this so that you can actually just put a monitor up on the wall and you can now have all of the monitor team specific information showing up through it. So it's also really useful if you want to have a walk-by monitor that people can see as an easy way to also see what the health of the system looks like in one at a glance view. So again, super simple scenario, but once you start taking advantage of it, can make a number of information sharing scenarios really easy. Another service or feature that we've had in Azure now for good 6 or 8 months that I still talk to a lot of people that have no idea that this thing exists is the Azure Advisor Service. How many people here have used the Azure Advisor Service? Good, meaning most people haven't, so this would be a good tip. If you haven't used it, please do use it. It's free, so you pay nothing to use it, and it's basically an advisor service that we provide in an automated way that will look through everything you're doing in Azure and make recommendations based on a bunch of rules that we've identified. And I think there's about 70 rules that we have now, and we're basically pushing every service add more rules to help automate so that people can actually better learn how to use the product, save money, be more reliable, be more secure. And basically the way this thing works is, let me go back to my other dashboard, by the way, is if you scroll down in your left-hand menu, for existing Azure customers, it's probably one of the last things on the menu just because we didn't want to mess up your left-hand nav order. And so it's this thing called Advisor. You click it, and what it does is it immediately starts looking at your active subscription. If you have multiple subscriptions, you can choose which one. And it will tell you all the things that we recommend to make the apps inside that subscription better. So for example, the first one here basically says, hey, your virtual machine has low usage. In other words, you've got a bunch of VMs where you're paying way too much. And we'll even calculate for you if you actually turn them off or you actually cycle them down. Here's all the money on a per VM basis that you can save per month simply by resizing the virtual machine. And we have a handy link that lets you do that. Click the link, resize it, save £100 a month. And we're using machine learning where we basically look at your CPU cycle. And so we see the CPU and the usage and the network is always consistently low. We'll tell you, you should really turn this off and save it. Similarly, we can look at places where you are not configured for high availability. And they'll talk about availability sets and managed disks next. But we'll basically highlight, hey, you've got a virtual machine here, or three sets of virtual machines that are not configured to run an availability set, which basically means they're not set up for high availability. And if that VM ever went down and your application has a dependency on it, your app would go down. And so what we highly recommend is create another virtual machine, put them in an availability set. We'll guarantee we isolate them within Azure so that the likelihood of the same machine going down at the same time is very low. This is how you get a high SLA. This is how you actually get better availability. And again, we kind of guide you through with this wizard on how to do it. Security, which we'll talk about in a little bit. We kind of recommend, hey, you should run the Security Center, which I talked about earlier, and go ahead and follow all those recommendations. We plug that through here as well. And then on the performance side, if we see any cases where we showed you how to save money with the cost saving of turning stuff down, but if we see any cases where you have a VM or a resource which is getting close to the quota throttle limit of that particular VM, so say, for example, your CPU is at 80 or 90%, we'll actually recommend, hey, you might want to upgrade the size of that VM to be able to handle more. This is particularly useful when you have a storage account, because storage accounts sometimes, as you add more load into your system, are a subtle thing that creep up in terms of usage. Again, this way we can basically warn you before you actually hit the limit that you're currently configured for, and you can go ahead and resize it. So lots of things you can take advantage of. Again, the beauty is you can run this thing on any subscription. You can filter by resource group. You can also, for any recommendation, if you think, hey, this is a great recommendation, but I don't want to do it now, click the snooze button and say, hey, remind me again in a month. And we will pull it out of the list, and we'll make sure that the next time you run the wizard, it doesn't show up, or it doesn't show up until that period of time you specified. So it's an easy way, if you get like thousands of recommendations, you go, oh, I'm overwhelmed, pick the 10 that are most important, then come back next week, do the next 10, and so forth. Again, a great way you can basically continuously improve your Azure experience. And as we learn more, we'll automate more here and help guide you to success. How many people here are going to use the Azure Advisor now? Good, more hands. One other thing I'll mention in terms of VMs, that's another little tip and trick. I don't have a slide on it, but it comes into play with those VMs that are sitting idle. Often what we find is they're often dev test VMs where someone on the team spun something up, did something with them, and forgot to turn them off. Cool feature that we have built in now on each VM is this little thing called auto shutdown. And so if you click this, you can actually go ahead and enable it and say shut this thing down automatically. You can also fire off a webhook URL so that you can have a function that actually says do shut down or don't shut down. And then it will automatically shut it down if you don't respond. There's also a way, if you turn on our Dev Test Labs, which is also a free service, you can auto start it up. The fascinating thing that we discovered when we started using this inside Microsoft is we originally did an auto shutdown rule. We turned off stuff Friday night that were idle. We turned it back on Monday morning before work, thinking that would be wonderful. It saved us a whole bunch of money because it basically meant most of these VMs didn't have to sit around and use it Saturday and Sunday. As an experiment, we said, what if we don't turn it on Monday? How many of these VMs will actually get turned on? And what we discovered is only 40% of VMs that were created ever got turned on again. And that saved us a heck of a lot more money to the tune of like $100 million a year because we have a lot of engineers. Again, it's worth turning it on. And then when you set it, avoid turning on the auto startup rule and just see how many people actually do start it up before you do, because you might actually find that fewer people end up recreating that VM versus just creating a new one at a later point. Availability set. So I talked about one of the things in the Azure Advisor rules that we point out is any VMs that are not running in what we call an availability set. And an availability set in Azure is a really important concept that sometimes people don't realize, unfortunately, until they have a problem that they should have been taking advantage of. And basically what an availability set lets you do is take a deployment of multiple VMs that you do, and basically you tag it to say, I want to run this in availability set. So I might say, I'm going to have a set of web front ends. I could create a web front end availability set, and I'm going to have a bunch of back end databases, and I could create a database availability set. And any VM that you put in that availability set, or the VMs that you do put in that availability set, we will automatically distribute across Azure so that there shouldn't be any single point of failure across those virtual machines. So in other words, you deploy three VMs, we'll make sure that we put them on three separate servers in three separate racks with three separate top-of-rack routers with three separate power supplies in the data center. And what that means is if a rack or a server goes down, well then, you know, when you wire up the load balancer itself is also put in an availability set. And what that should mean is even if a top-of-rack router goes down, a server goes down, a rack goes down, you have at least two other instances of your app or VM running that the traffic will be diverted to. And our load balancer will automatically pull traffic out of rotation or a VM out of rotation if it can't see a healthy signal. I think by default it's every 30 seconds, so you can change the rule. At which point, even though there is a failure happening, you aren't impacted. Because your app is designed with it. So it's a pretty important concept to add in because it will dramatically improve your overall availability. And if you run the Azure Advisor, we'll tell you every VM out there that is not configured in an availability set and basically ask you, hey, if this is just for dev test, it doesn't have to be, but if this really is a production VM, highly recommend you put it in an availability set. And you do need to put a VM in an availability set at the time it's created. Because we have to place that VM on the right place of the data center at creation time. Otherwise, if you create five VMs and then try to add them to an availability set, which we don't allow, it could be that those five VMs happen to be in the same rack and we can't provide that same promise. So it's best when you're doing production to create an availability set first and then add all the VMs into it and we'll take care of and automate the rest. So the other thing that... So this we've had in the platform for years. We still have lots of people that don't know about this, but we keep trying to reinforce why it's so critical. And the Azure Advisor, again, will help you pinpoint it. The other feature that we've not had for many years, but we do now have now and highly recommend, is something we call managed disks. And this is beneficial for many reasons, one of which is it makes your system even more highly available. And basically, what we did historically in Azure at the beginning when we did IaaS is when you created a VM, we'd place the VM in an availability set, we'd guarantee the VM was isolated, and then you typically created what was called a storage account that you then put the VM's data disks into. And what often happened was you'd end up having VM1, VM2 that were fully isolated in the data center, but you might have put both their disks in a single storage account, which basically means you can survive the compute rack going down, you could survive a compute server going down, a compute router going down, but if the underlying storage cluster had a problem, both VMs would go down because both their disks would suddenly go offline. The nice thing with managed disks is we no longer put disks in a storage account. Instead, we put them, treat them as a top-level management object, which has other benefits, meaning it's a lot easier to work with. And one of the principles that we promise is that we will put those disks at runtime on separate independent storage units. And what that means now is if we have a storage failure, and they're rare, but they occasionally a cluster might run into problems and either have perf problems or what have you, it should ensure that only a third of your VMs are impacted. And so if they're in an availability set, your application should not go down. It would never have a problem in this type of configuration. And that's a nice thing that we can just promise to you as part of it. And that's one of the reasons why the Azure Advisor now recommends converting your disk to be managed disks going forward. The other big benefits with managed disks are it's much easier to manage. And so we often hear from people, gosh, it's a pain managing disks because I have to copy them within storage accounts. If I put too many disks in a single storage account, I start running into quota throttle limits, et cetera. Now with managed disks, you just say how fast you want the disk, how much you want the disk in terms of size. We take care of everything else, and they're a very simple object to write script against and work with. And there's no quota throttling limits that you ever run into as part of that. We also, because they're no longer in a storage account, there is no IP address to the disk. And so we often heard from enterprises that said, hey, even though I've ACLed the storage account, I'm still uncomfortable that if the storage account key was compromised, someone could download the disk. Now it's a completely isolated, secure object that you can't ever directly access and download, which is an additional security prevention mechanism. And you know, in general, again, from the management perspective, they're just a lot easier to use. So definitely recommend using managed disks. If you have existing VMs, it's actually pretty easy to update them to use managed disks. You don't have to. So there's not like there's some time period that you have to make this conversion. But if better reliability, better security, and better ease of management isn't is hopefully a compelling reason to start using them, the good news is it's pretty easy to do. This is the three commands that you would run on an existing VM to convert it to use managed disks. You don't have to recreate the VM. You simply stop the VM. You run a deallocate command. You convert. You start up the VM again. The IP address, the configuration, the network settings are all the same. And now your disks are guaranteed to be isolated from all the other disks in the availability set. Better performance, better reliability, better boot time, better security, and much better availability. So compelling reasons why to run those three commands. There's also a PowerShell equivalent that you can also use for PowerShell, and we do have articles for both those on how to use them. If you do have an app deployed and they're in an availability set, you can just take one VM offline, convert it, bring it back, do the next VM, take it offline, convert it, bring it back, and just walk through it, and that way you'd have zero downtime and zero unavailability as part of that process. We do have a script, if you look at our sample section, that shows you how to do that. It even shows you how to pull the VM off the load balancer first, wait for the connections to drain, then do it, bring it back, and walk it. So you know, with 10 or 15 lines of PowerShell or Bash CLI, you can convert any running deployment with zero downtime. Again, much better reliability as part of it. In our initial first 3 or 4 months since we've had the general availability of managed disks, we basically find that VMs that use managed disks have 75% better availability than VMs that don't. So 75% better is a lot in a cloud world. And again, our unmanaged disks still had 99 worth of availability, but 75% better is a big deal. And again, we can see that it makes a big difference. So one thing you can do, when you use the CLI to create a VM, by default now, it will use managed disks. So just automatically, because it's a new CLI, and we just decided to change that behavior since it was GAing at the same time as managed disks. When you create a new VM today, it's not in the portal, it's not yet using managed disks by default. It will shortly. We just wanted to make sure that managed disks were available in all regions, before we flip the default on people for new VMs, and they now are, or they will be in the next sort of 2 weeks, at which point we're planning on changing the default. And so just to kind of give you an example of how you do this today, though. I could go ahead, and it's on the second part of the wizard instead of the first, which is why I got to fill out those things. Actually, it's on the third, not the second. But right now, we ask this question at the top, which says, do you want to use managed disks? And basically, if you want to use them today, you click yes, at which point you'll notice the storage account thing disappears because you no longer have a storage account, which again saves you an object and makes it easier to script. But that's how you do to take advantage of managed disks today if you create new VMs, is just flip that toggle. Again, in about a month, it'll be set to yes by default. We'll hopefully flip the order so that yes is first and not no first. And we'll still give you the ability to use unmanaged disks if for some reason you want to, but again, we think there's almost universally positive reasons to use managed disks going forward, and we think they bring a lot of benefits. And the cool thing is you can use them today with your deployments. Another infrastructure tip and trick that I highly recommend is something called VM scale sets. How many people here are using VM scale sets? Okay, only a few people. Good. Hopefully either you're asleep or there's lots of new tips and tricks I'm sharing. Good. So VM scale sets is a pretty cool feature that, again, for a lot of people I talk to, when they hear it, they go, wow, why am I not using that? Because it solves a whole bunch of problems. And it's also gotten very rich over the last couple months, and you'll see it get even richer over the next 6 months. So it's definitely something to start using because you'll get more and more features from it. And basically what VM scale sets are designed to do is enable you to create lots of VMs at scale, where the scale could be 2 VMs or the scale could be 1,000 VMs. And basically it gives you a way you can take an image of a VM, either a base image like a vanilla Windows Server or Ubuntu or SUSE Linux image, and say, give me 10 instances of these. Or what you can do is you can take a VM, install IIS or install Nginx, configure it however you want, and then basically capture an image as a custom image and then give that image to a VM scale set and say, create 100 of these for me. And we will basically in parallel build out those VMs and run them as a unit that you can manage as a group, as opposed to have to manage and configure every individual VM separately. Couple big benefits of this. One is it's much easier to automate because you no longer have to write like a for loop that goes over 100 VMs. It's much, much faster to deploy. If you create a for loop with 100 VMs and it's done serially, it will take you probably on average 100 times longer to deploy than if you used a VM scale set because you're basically doing one VM at a time, whereas a VM scale set will do it in parallel. Another neat trick that we do with VM scale sets is because it's a fixed image you're giving us, we actually cheat under the covers. So if you say create 100 VMs in a VM scale set, we will actually create like 115 VMs. And then as soon as the first 100 VMs boot, we shoot the remainder 15, and we only ever bill you for the 100. And that basically means when we place VMs around the data center, if any server is very busy and it's just taking a little bit longer to boot, we handle that for you, and that basically allows us to spin up lots of VMs very quickly. We've had tests where we can do 1,000 VMs in about 75 seconds. And have them booted and fully ready as a result. So you can deploy very, very fast, and you'll see these times get better and better throughout the calendar year. And then what's great is you can manage these things really as a cluster, and so you could add and remove the number of VMs dynamically. You can patch and update the VMs as a batch, and a whole bunch of other administration cycles. And what's nice with the VM scale set is it's not all or nothing. So if you wanted to, for example, have a database VM image that you handle on a one-off basis or as a single unit traditional VM, you can do that. But then you could say, I want all my middle tier or all my web tier to be in a VM scale set and boot up lots of those instances at a time. And again, it works with standard or custom images. You can actually have them be stateless VMs, or you can attach managed disks to them now, so you can have them be stateful VMs as well. And by default, the VM scale set's automatically put in an availability set, so we distribute them for high availability. And we automatically wire up a load balancer for them as well as an additional management option that you can use. And creating them is pretty easy. This is basically a simple one-liner that you can run with the Azure CLI that I showed earlier in the first talk, where if I wanted to create a big cluster of VMs, I could say, point to my Ubuntu image, create 1,000 of them. I could point to a load balancer or just say no load balancer, depending on what I want. I could optionally set a subnet address, boom, go, and 90 seconds later, I start to have VMs I can start to use, 1,000 of them, and this could create, you know, upwards of, say, 28,000 cores of compute that you can take advantage of very, very quickly. VM scale sets now support auto scale rules. So you can also, when you create a scale set, basically say, hey, automatically scale up or scale down the scale set based on what is actually happening in the application. And so you can either do timer-based rules, or you could basically do it on CPU. And then we also at build just shipped the ability to do custom metrics. So you could even do things like, you know, measure the availability of your website or the latency of your website responses, or measure, you know, any arbitrary metric you want and scale up or scale down based on that in a completely automated fashion, which is kind of cool. And then because VM scale sets support availability sets, we place the VMs automatically across the data center to make sure that we maximize availability so that if anything goes down, the scale set should still stay up. And then the other thing that we do is we provide a way with scale sets that you can update images dynamically. So if you want to patch your images or you want to roll out a new version of that VM, you can give us an image and say update it, and we will walk the appropriate domains in a way so that as we're updating your VMs, also if there was suddenly a hardware failure that happened inside the data center, you wouldn't basically be in a destabilized situation. What does that mean? So we isolate the VMs, but it also means that when we update them in a certain order, so that if suddenly one or two fault domains suddenly failed, if you were all updating lots of VMs here and here, your whole system would come crashing down. And so when we update them, then we walk them not just across the fault domain, but across what we call an update domain, so that we maintain maximum availability and ensure that everything happens. And that is a whole bunch of script that you'd otherwise have to write, say, with other cloud providers manually, that we can basically, with a single command, now automate for you. So what does a scale set look like? So I showed you how you can create one here from a command line. We often see, we do have the ability to create a scale set through the portal. What we generally find is people often, since it's now a single command, just do it from PowerShell or CLI. Again, rather than Ubuntu, you could specify my custom web server, and that could be either a Windows or Linux image that already had everything configured. So again, you can use custom images as part of it. And then once they're deployed, we do actually have a unique resource type that surfaces in the management portal called the VM scale set, which contains VMs. And so what I'm looking at here is my VM scale set management blade. And you know all the standard stuff for the VM scale set object. You'll notice the CPU utilization. What's cool about this is not showing me a single VM. This is, in fact, showing me the CPU of the 100 VM instances running in this VM scale set. So we're aggregating all the counters from those 100 VMs. And you can see, basically, the aggregate CPU across the scale set is running at, in this case, 67% right now. And so we provide a whole bunch of these management hooks that, again, you'd otherwise have to manually aggregate across all the different VMs. If I want to see the individual VMs, click on the Instances tab, and this will basically show me all the different VMs. If I wanted to shoot a couple of these VMs, I could just click them and hit deallocate or delete. If for some reason I think I'm getting configuration drift, like in other words, I'm using Chef or Ansible or Puppet and doing configuration management on the VM, and I think like, for some reason, this node is throwing more errors, and I'm not sure, did my Chef script for some reason not update? I could just go ahead and re-image that VM, set it back to the base state, and then have Chef bring it back up to speed. And because when I created the VM scale set, I gave Azure an image of what the base VM should look like, all I need to do is just click re-image, and Azure will basically take those three out of rotation, update it, bring it back, and it should be back in the pristine state when I first deployed it, which is a very useful case when you end up having configuration drift and or application code drifts inside your environment. You should still probably figure out why it didn't happen, but it's super useful when it starts breaking to be able to kind of reset it in a quick state. As I mentioned, you can scale a VM scale set either through auto-scale rules or manually. And so in this case here, I have 100 VMs in the scale set. If I wanted to, I could click 1,000, click save, and then Azure would automatically expand the scale set to be 1,000 VMs with the same image, have the load balancer, the availability set, and all the rules automatically configured for me. Or if I wanted to, I could scale it down to 10, or 95, or whatever I select in the slider, and it would basically slide those down as well. And no application downtime. As part of this, it would automatically manage that whole thing for me. And if I turn on auto scale and set up an auto scale rule, I can have all this be done dynamically as part of it. So definitely something to look at. If you're doing HPC workloads, this is a great way to do it. If you're doing Hadoop clusters, this is a great way to do it. If you're manually setting up infrastructure for container services or for web front ends, and you're not using our managed container service, service fabric, or app service, this is a great way to do it. And internally within Azure, one kind of trick that we do is we actually build much of our own services on top of VM scale sets, pretty much all of our new services on top of VM scale sets. And so underneath a service fabric, underneath a container service, going forward underneath app services, there is actually a VM scale set at work that's actually doing all the infrastructure work for us. And so we're trying to layer our services to build on top of it and give you always the flexibility that you can go down to the VM scale set level if you want to and have control. One thing you'll see us roll out later this year that we're excited about is also auto patching support. So for a lot of people here that maybe were building on the original cloud services model we had inside Azure, one thing that people really like about it is when the OS patches, it automatically updates to the latest OS family. We'll have that as a feature in VM scale sets. And so as part of your image, you can just say auto patch. And when a Windows or a Linux patch comes out, we will automatically roll through your VM scale set and do OS patching for you automatically as a service. Which gives you that same capabilities that you have with cloud services. And then we're also going to be coming out with web and worker role images for VM scale sets. So if you do have an existing cloud service deployment, you'll be able to take the code and run it on a VM scale set with that auto OS patching with the web and worker images that we provide. And with hopefully almost no, if any, code changes required, you can actually run on top of a VM scale set your existing cloud service capability and take advantage of all these additional services in addition to the ones you already have. So it's a little bit about VM scale sets. Azure Security Center. So I talked about this in the first talk. I'm just going to go a little bit deeper on it now. But this is definitely a service I highly recommend if you haven't checked out that you should look at hard with Azure because it does enable you to be much, much more secure. A lot of the capabilities in it are completely for free and available to every Azure customer. And then there's some more advanced features, which I'll show here, that you can also leverage, some of which you have to pay extra for because we do log analysis and log storage for you as part of it. But I think are well worth the incremental cost that it takes because it does enable you to have kind of a much more secure system. And one thing that we do as part of the Security Center, actually before I give you the demo, I just want to mention is it works not just with Azure services, but we also integrate with other security vendors out there. And so if your company already uses, say, Barracuda or F5 or Cisco or Checkpoint or Trend Micro or any of the other different cloud or security vendors out there for on-prem, you can use those with Azure Security Center, and we can actually aggregate the logs across all the different security products and be able to surface them in one dashboard. And then the other thing that we do is everything that I'll show you through the GUI, through the web portal with Security Center, we also expose as an API and as a management pack that you can plug into other security products that you already own. So if your company uses, for example, Splunk or ArcSight or some of the other security SIEM products that security operation centers on premises typically use, you can basically plug in the Splunk pack for Azure, download everything that I'm going to show you in our web portal, and it will just show up in your security operation center so your security professionals can see it just the way they would if the server was sitting around the corner back at work. And that's a great way that you can get a security team feeling comfortable about cloud because they can basically now use this exact same tools that they already use today on premises, but they can now use in a cloud-based model. The other thing that we are adding, it's today available through our operations management suite, is a set of agents that you can also install on-premises, which also then will pull your on-premises security log data into Azure and enable you to use the Azure Security Center UI to also monitor and manage your on-prem assets. And you'll see that even deeper integrated inside Azure over the next couple months. And so that also gives you a great hybrid security story that you can do with both our products and then with other security products out there that we've integrated with. So again, to use Security Center, just click on the Security Center link on the left-hand tab. This loads up our Security Center console. I showed you in talk one how you can click on Compute Networking Storage Data Applications, and we show you a whole bunch of recommendations of what you should do proactively to your deployments on Azure to make them more secure. Please, please, please do look at those and follow those because they're really, really good recommendations and can really help make you even more secure in this world where the sophistication of attacks are becoming higher and higher. I'm not going to show you those again. Instead, I'm going to focus on this other tile here called Security Alerts, which is another cool thing, which is not focused so much on prevention, but really more focused on detection of security attacks that are actually happening. And you can also see most attacked resources, which will actually tell you what part of your environment are we actually seeing the most attack attempts against as part of it. And you might say, good God, why am I being attacked? Unfortunately, that is the internet. And so the typical IP address on the internet gets attacked at least 10 times per day. So when you think about security attacks, don't think of it, is it happening? It's more a case of how many times a day is it happening to you? And do you know it's happening? And the scariest thing is when people say, hey, I never actually am attacked by security. That means you almost certainly are, and you just don't know it. Because if you're not seeing alerts go off, it means that your warning detection radar signals are probably not working because you are being attacked in some way, shape, or form, typically, in anything, whether it's cloud or not cloud related. So let's go ahead and click on Security Center and show you the types of attacks that we can show against you that might be happening. And again, the beauty is we will show you these attacks, not just ones that we've detected against your environment, but also ones that if you have Barracuda or you have Cisco security products, we will aggregate their signals as well into this unified view. So you really can see a 360-degree view of all the attacks that are happening against you. And you know, examples would be script injection attacks against web fields on your websites, SQL injection attacks that we talked about earlier, where people are trying to put in bogus SQL values. Password attacks. So any port you have open on the internet, especially if you have a management port, guarantee there is someone who has bought a dictionary of passwords through the black market, through the Yahoo breach, or say through one of the other famous web properties that got breached. And they basically will just randomly go through that password dictionary, trying every single one against your management port. There's a finite number of passwords, unfortunately, in the world, because most people use one of about 100,000 common passwords. And if you use your favorite color, if you use your favorite friend, if you use the place you were born, there's only so many places on Earth where people are born. It's not that hard, unfortunately, to sometimes guess those passwords. And you know, there's people out there that do automated attacks trying to do it. And so we'll tell you every time we see that happening. And again, our security best practice analyzer will tell you how not to create an insecure password or how to close your management ports so that they can't do that against you. So do follow the preventions, but this will basically still tell you any place where we are seeing stuff that's happening. You know, one challenge with security is because there are so many threats happening out there in the world today, you can very easily miss what I call the forest for the trees. And in fact, if you look at most companies that have been hacked, it wasn't that they didn't actually have something logged that indicated they were hacked. The problem was that thing was one of 25,000 other things that were logged that week about security, and they missed it. And so most of these security hacks, it wasn't that something didn't go ding. It was the fact that they had so much noise because so many things were constantly being probed that they couldn't actually make sense of an attack that was happening. So one of the things we do have at the Security Center we're pretty happy with is built-in machine learning that constantly looks at the logs so that we don't just show you that someone is trying to probe your system, but we can actually put the signals together to try to create a path to indicate whether an actual breach or incident is really happening. And so in this case here, someone's deployed an application. So this is not an Azure issue, this is actually an application issue. And you can basically see here, we've noticed an actor is trying to do a SQL injection against the system. Good news, it was blocked. So this wasn't actually a security incident because it was blocked. But we noticed someone was doing it. They then switched to do an RDP brute force attack. So they're looking for VMs where you have either an SSH or an RDP management port open. They find it, then they start randomly trying passwords and usernames to see if they can break in. You can notice it was blocked, and so we can automatically detect someone's tried 1,000 passwords and they haven't got in. But then we discovered, you're using a password that wasn't very secure, or that you've used somewhere else that someone has gotten access to, and they actually were successful, and we can tell that that actor just logged into that VM as an administrator. We can then detect a suspicious process just started on that VM of yours, and that's a sign that malware potentially is now starting to happen, or someone's writing code in your environment. We can automatically look at your Active Directory usage if you turn this on, and actually say, suddenly this VM is querying domain accounts that they've never accessed before, and then we've noticed your app is now talking to a suspicious machine on the internet that we suspect is being a command and control center for malware. This is a very bad sign when you see this particular sequence happen, and this is what we would elevate using our machine learning as a real incident. And the nice thing, the Security Center will automatically reach out to you and say, we think you have an issue with your application. Here's the timeline that causes us to think this is the issue. Here's what you should go to do to actually take action based on it. And so if you turn this on, you actually now have sort of a security professional automatically watching over your shoulder who can help make you much more secure. And again, all these things that I'm describing happen on premises as well today. So this isn't like something that's cloud specific. All this can happen with your existing applications that you host in your own data centers. The nice thing though about cloud is because we actually know the network, the storage, the infrastructure, the management, we can actually protect you a lot better than you often can in your own environment, because we can actually give you this 360-degree signal in a way that a traditional enterprise environment that has lots and lots of different equipment and manufacturers probably can't. So definitely recommend turning this on. We've helped a lot of customers discover things that they didn't know, and really helped a number of people with it. And again, you can configure all this from an alerting perspective, so you don't actually have to have someone sitting in the management console. You can wire up an alert so that we'll automatically email you or call you anytime we see something that looks suspicious. And again, everything I showed you in that view, you can pump into your existing Security Operations Center SIEM tool if you already have one on premises, regardless of whether it's Splunk, ArcSight, or someone else, other vendor. And so your existing security team, if you're an enterprise or a company that already has one, can basically use their existing tools to see all this data and be much more secure as a result. Speaking of security, how many people here know that Azure has what's called role-based access control? Great. How many people here have configured their resources to be locked down with role-based access control? Fewer hands. But some people have. Good. This is one where, again, it's a great tip and trick that makes sense, but a lot of people don't either know to do it or forgotten to do it, or frankly aren't sure how to get started doing it. And one of the things that we've done a bunch of updates on, even in the last month or so, is just to make it a lot easier to see who has access to your resources in your team and what permissions they have and how to lock it down even more to make your system more secure. And so basically with role-based access control, which works with anything managed through Azure Resource Management API, it basically allows you to get very granular permissions set on any resource that you manage in Azure. So you can say, for this VM, Joe can only read access to see whether it's healthy. He can't log in, he can't delete it, he can't resize it, he can't do anything else. You can get that level of granularity and be able to lock down things as much as possible. And we have a bunch of built-in roles that we provide out of the box. So you don't even have to create new role definitions if you want, but you can also create your own roles and define your own set of permissions if you want to get super granular as part of it. And basically the key idea is you create a role which describes a set of permissions, and then you assign users into it. And with a role definition, you can use it across multiple resources. With role assignments, you can also set it so it's inherited. So you can set permissions at the subscription level and then override them at the resource group level or at an individual resource level. And so as an example, I might have contributors, owners, and readers. And I might say, hey, I'm going to have one person who's an owner of an Azure subscription. So they're kind of like the god user of that subscription. And they're allowed to do certain things. I'm going to deliberately scope it down so there's only one of them or only one account that we don't actually actively use doing it, just to make sure. And then I'm going to have multiple apps, each in a separate resource group, and I'm going to make sure that only the people that work on that app have any ownership permissions, and that way if their account was somehow stolen, they couldn't impact other apps. And within that team, I'm even going to define people so that my developers in the dev test environment, they have the ability to change things. But in production, only people in, say, the operator environment, which might be a subset of my developers or a completely different team, they're the only ones that can actually change stuff. But I still want my developers to be able to read the environment, so they can still see monitoring data. But they're not allowed to delete things. They're not allowed to get access to the production cert. And nope, we're not going yet. And so very fine-grained level stuff you can do. And the beauty is because it's in the Azure management system, it again works in a granular level, the REST level API, but it also works through the portal, it works through the CLI, it works through PowerShell, it works through Visual Studio, it works through the APIs. And so once you set it, it really does protect everything as opposed to just through the UI. The other thing you can do is, we've built in, and I'll demo all this in just a second, is we now have what's called an activity log that's built into Azure that you can get access to on a per resource level, or you can see it across all the resources that you have inside Azure, where when you click on the activity log, we'll audit any operation that happens through the management API, so you can also see who did what in an environment after the fact. And if you optionally, you can even save your logs now forever if you want to. So if a year later you want to figure out who is the person that actually changed this password, you can go back in time and see, gosh, it was Joe, it was on this machine at this time, here's the proof that he did it. It's useful both, you know, in cases where you want to be able to audit things for security reasons. It's also incredibly useful when something breaks. The number of times we talk to customers and they say, I didn't touch anything. And we say, hey, go to the activity log. I didn't touch anything. No, just go to the activity log. Look, I didn't touch, wait. Joe, what did you do? What is this thing? And, you know, it's useful, especially in a team environment, that you can actually see exactly, oh, that thing that changed 4 minutes before the alert went off, let's change it back and see what happens. You know, not always, but you'd be surprised, at least half the time, incidents tend to happen because of change, sometimes either change in our environment or often change at the application layer. So let's look at how you can use this. So let me pull up a resource. So this is just a VM here. And one of the things that we've done, but this works, what I'm going to show you here should work on pretty much every resource in Azure that's managed through the Azure Resource Manager. So that's pretty much all resources now, with one or two exceptions, and then everything new that you create. There is this third tab below overview. There's the activity log. That's the audit log we'll come back to. Is this thing called access control. And I have to confess, I felt like the UI that we had there was not super good. A couple months ago, it was very confusing. We tried to clean it up quite a bit, and this is the new UI that we just shipped recently in the last sort of month or two that's now live, that I think is a lot cleaner and makes a lot more sense in terms of how you manage things. And basically what it does when you click on it is it will show you for this particular resource who is in various roles. So you can see here there are four owners that have full admin access, meaning they can delete it, they can change things on it. I've got three people that have a subset, or what we call contributor access. They can't delete it, as an example. They can't change the password, as an example. But they can change simple things. And then if I wanted to, I could also create a reader role, which basically means you can see everything, except for confidential secrets. But you can see, is the machine healthy? What's the metrics log? When was it last started? But you can't change anything. And what's nice is I can see this in one view. You can also see on the right-hand side where these settings are coming from. The inheritance thing is super powerful, but it also confuses people, which is why we put it here. It is often you add people to a subscription and you don't realize, ooh, when I did it, they now have permission to everything in that subscription. So it's really useful to go into anything you're deploying in production, click on it, and then say, gosh, why does Joe have owner access? Oh, I added him up here. Let me go up there, I'm going to change his access, and I'm going to explicitly not have him be owner for everything. I'm just going to give him owner for what he needs to be. And this way, you can easily, when you see a person in that list that you don't understand why they have ownership privileges, scroll to the right, and now you can see exactly where they're getting the privilege from. You can click on it and then basically change it, and makes it much easier to lock things down. You can also filter based on roles, scope. There's a whole bunch of stuff you can do here that's more advanced, but hopefully this default view is useful. If you want to add someone or delete someone, you can also do that. So if you click add permission, it's pretty easy now to create new roles. And so you can see these are some custom roles. These are the standard owner, contributor, reader. So let's say I want to add a new user to this project. They're a junior member of the project, so I want to be careful that they don't have too much permissions. So I can now select who they are, either by typing in a name or a role. So I'm going to add this person's name. They have lots of potential, but still we don't give them too much privileges. What's nice here is you notice we do integrate with Active Directory. And so if you use Azure Active Directory, which everyone does when they're in Azure, you see all your cloud users. If you sync it with your on-prem environment, you pick up everything. So that's why you see his picture. It's because it comes out of our enterprise Active Directory. I click Save. And basically, this is updating that particular resource. And now, if I come here and hit Refresh, what I'll see is, instead of just having users in two roles, what I should see here in just a second is I now have three roles with one user in that role. And again, you can see it was set at this resource level. Their reader, that's who they are. And again, simple way that I can now add and remove things. And if I basically say, hey, you've checked in one too many bugs, I'm going to remove you entirely. Just go ahead and hit remove. And now he has to look over someone's shoulder anytime they want to see something inside the site. So that's pretty easy how you can add and remove permissions. Again, best practice, look at the permissions you have set for all your resources. You'll probably be surprised how many people, if you're in a team environment, have permissions that they don't really absolutely need to do. Other thing you can do here then is, let's see here. If you go to the activity log on a resource, you can also go back and filter why. Maybe I created this thing a long time ago, actually. I don't remember when I created this resource. Apparently it was longer ago than I thought, but I could basically go into either at the resource level, if there's anything I changed on it, or I can go ahead and click at the monitoring level for all of Azure, click activity log, and you can basically see any operation, including reading keys as part of my monitoring system. I could go ahead and say, show me administrative activities in the last 6 hours, this is places where I've got a script that I've written things, et cetera. So this is that audit log. And for anything where I've done something, I can go ahead and who's initiated it. I can list the exact action that happened. Since it's a key, maybe I won't actually show it. I don't think it actually shows it, but just in case. But this is that audit log that I can basically go after the fact if I want to understand who changed what in the environment and go do. Last thing I'll mention is we now have Azure Active Directory manageable through Azure, the Azure standard Azure Management Console. So you can now manage all your users inside your directory as well in one place. The other thing you can do as part of this is set up not just users and roles, but you can also create what's called a service principal. And a service principal is like a user account, but is even more locked down in terms of what it can do. And specifically, service principals aren't allowed to log in interactively into the console. And so anytime, for example, you have like a CI/CD server inside VSTS that is pushing stuff into deployment, rather than please don't enter your own username password into your build script, because if your build environment is ever compromised, they now have your username password. Instead, create a service principal that's specific to like my build server, lock it down, using that same UI I showed you so that it can only deploy things on that particular resources that it needs to, and then use that inside your build environment. And that way, if your build environment was ever compromised, you don't end up with a situation where you've given access to all of your production deployments through it. That's another best practice, and you can now manage that in addition to users and roles directly in the Azure Active Directory console. So, Azure Monitor. So another built-in experience that we've added into Azure, and which we're kind of making richer and richer almost on a weekly, if not monthly, or certainly monthly basis, is our Azure Monitor experience. And this is something where you know, based on working with lots of customers, what we hear is, you know, how do you help me understand not just how to manage stuff in Azure, but like, is it working? And when I have a bug in my application, how the heck do I figure out, A, that there's a bug before my customer tells me there's a bug, and B, how can I actually pinpoint what the problem is? And, you know, historically, you had to piece together your own kind of monitoring and management infrastructure to do a lot of these things. And what we're trying to do is basically just build into the product an experience that makes it easy for you to capture all this information. And for at least 99% of scenarios, how do we just make it so that you just can log in and get a great monitoring management experience without having to buy anything or integrate anything yourself? You always can, but and we always have a third-party API integration as part of it. But you know, we kind of increasingly think the expectation is the cloud platform just has that out of the box. And so with Azure Monitor, that's sort of what we're doing, and it's getting richer and richer in terms of doing it. So I showed you the activity log in the last tip and trick. This shows you in one place everything that's changed in your environment. Anytime you have a problem, definitely recommend first go check the activity log. Who changed what in the environment? And is there any correlation with the problem starting when they did? We also now have a metrics view where basically across any resource, you can now query their live metrics from a time series perspective. And we're updating all Azure resources to dump everything in the metrics view, so that not only can you do it in one place, but also the time clocks are all synchronized, which is another challenge that you have with independent multiple monitoring systems, is the clock drift ends up making it a nightmare to correlate events across each other. We also have built-in log search, so you can actually take the raw diagnostic logs off of a service, and you can now write queries against them and be able to process millions of entries very quickly. I'll show a demo of that in just a second. We now have our network watcher support as well, so that not only do we let you monitor the raw services, monitor the diagnostic logs, you can also now, and we actually shipped this a couple months ago, I just realized the slide is old, so we will make a real-time Agile update. And what this basically lets you do is even go ahead and do diagnostic information at the network level inside the data center. And so this is not actually the physical hardware. This is the logical view of all your resources and the logical hardware expressed through virtualization. And we can actually now let you do packet trace captures and use standard like Wireshark tools to be able to visualize and actually understand anytime you have network interruptions. Is that because you have a network security group rule configured? Is the on-premise VPN hardware that you have having an issue talking with Azure? You know, this now is all built in and something I don't think any other cloud provider yet provides, and gives you kind of even more advanced networking monitoring support as part of it. So let's show off a couple of cool features or demos here. So you click the monitor tab on the left-hand side. It's there by default now. Again, I showed you the activity log earlier. Let's show the metrics view. So with the metrics view, I could do something like this. I could go and say, let me look at a particular resource that I'm working on. And those, here's some of those resources that we created. Let me look at, for example, what was that VM or the database or some of those web apps. Look at that one there. You can basically see, if I want to see, you know, what are, you know, what did it look like from a demo perspective? I can filter my HTTP requests. Hey, did any errors come? No, good. If I wanted to, I could basically, again, get a nice view for this. This works for any resource, so I can do this for databases, VMs, networks, et cetera. Again, because you have that pinning support, key thing is once you use the metrics view to come up with an interesting view, just pin it to your dashboard, especially if you have that multiple dashboards, and now that thing is there for me to see. And so this is a great way to go create the metrics for your apps, get them across all your resources, aggregate them together in a single dashboard, and now you have one heads-up display that you can use that's customized for your use case. The diagnostic log section basically gives you a pointer to any of the logs that we're generating from our services, and we're basically having all of our services now emit logs to a common diagnostic API and Dynamics log service. We give APIs to this, so you can pull this into Splunk or Datadogs or Sumo Logic or any of the other popular log search systems out there. And one of the things that we've been hard at work at has been really improving the latency of when the data shows up in the logs. We used to have 15 or 20 minutes latency sometimes for services. I think as a build, we're now down to about a minute granularity for services, which is, I think, the best in class for all the cloud providers. I think AWS is still about 5 minutes granularity. And that means that basically the data is there quickly, which means you can diagnose things. It also means you can write alerts and actually do things like auto-scale rules with much more accuracy, much faster. And then what you can do optionally is, again, you can take these logs and pull it into a third-party log search tool or build your own Elasticsearch or a Kibana log stash or some type of environment. Or you can use our built-in log search functionality, which we now build into the product itself. And so as an example here, if I want to write an arbitrary script or search, I can just do star. It's going to pull back all the records. One thing you'll notice is that just pulled back 2 million log entries pretty much in near real time. If I wanted to do like a more complex query like this, this is going to basically say, pull back my SQL Azure database metrics, pull back the CPU consumption, and what I want to do is measure it, the average, in an interval of 20 minutes over the last period of time. So it's a pretty analytic query, not just a simple select star. I can run it over these 2 million records, 648 results when there's time series together, and you can now see all my databases and what the average CPU time is across the pools that they're being managed in. So a pretty easy way that I can visualize it. If I want to sequence into a particular time period, I can, and I just double-clicked into that time series. And then if I use the table view, I can also now see a columnar view back of those log search results. And the cool thing is when you have millions of results, being able to do it this quickly ends up being super, super useful. And you know, traditionally, in most environments on premises, this would be pretty hard to do. And you can basically save this query. You can also save it as one of the tiles on a dashboard. So again, helps it quite a bit in terms of enabling you to diagnose what's going on and be able to immediately seek into it and be able to kind of help diagnose things in a much easier way. And again, what we're trying to do is just basically have this built in so that you don't have to install anything to take advantage of it. It just works. Our alerting system does now allow you to also set up automated alerts that will fire based on this log telemetry action happening. And I have like a billion alerts in the system because this is like 20 subscriptions of stuff. But basically for some of these things, I have no idea what this alert is, but we'll take a look at it. This thing, you can be sort of arbitrary complex in terms of logic. So this is basically, looks like set up on a log resource. It's not a very interesting alert. Hold on, let's build a new one. But what I could basically do when I create a new alert is I can choose what type of resource. I can basically choose what type of thing is happening. So I see errors happening, CPU spike, something went down, a new deployment happened. And then you'll notice built in here now, we have the ability to fire off an alert to a variety of different mechanisms. And so one of them is SMS. So we can now send you an automatic SMS alert. One is email. And then the other one is webhook. The nice thing with a webhook is you can call off to any system with that. So you call off to an Azure function. You could call off to PagerDuty if you wanted to build kind of a more advanced paging model where you have on-call engineers and it'll actually walk the on-call engineers until one of them responds. So if it's in the middle of the night, you don't wake up everyone. You can call off to any other third-party system as part of that. And that's now built in. And because our log granularity is now very fast, you know, these end up being much more accurate as part of it. And again, it's something you can now take advantage of and didn't exist a while ago. Action groups give you a way that instead of calling an individual person, you can actually call a group. So you could say, when there's an issue at night, call the on-call engineer. And then you just rotate who is the on-call engineer in the group. And that way you're not having to change thousands of rules every night, depending on who is the person on call. Auto-scale is another one that we've built in so that you can now auto-scale based on alerts instead of manually. And we have one unified way for doing going to one unified way to do auto-scale across all our services. So there's more stuff too, but it hopefully gives you a sense. Definitely check out the monitoring because there's a lot of richness there. What you're going to see is it keeps getting richer and richer month by month. And one of the models that we have internally that we talk about with Azure is how do we make first party equals third party, meaning how do we run our own services using the same stuff we tell you to run your services on? And so we've got internal customers at Microsoft, like Office 365, that are using the same monitoring infrastructure, which is one of the reasons why it's gotten so much better, is it's driving a lot of really, really large workload usages. And so some of our internal customers now send us about 3.5 petabytes of log data per day, which is a lot of logs, that we ingest into the system. And the good news is, because we can handle that amount of logs, I can almost guarantee we can handle your logs, because there's not many systems on the earth that handle more than 3.5 petabytes per day. And it can do it at less than 60-second alerting granularity. So the good news is, we're building our own stuff on that, and you'll continue to see it get better and better, because we also have some unique load requirements that really drive a lot of hardening in the system. So last tip and trick I'm going to talk about is what to do when things go wrong. And specifically, how do you diagnose and solve problems? And this is something we're also trying to really drive into the experience, so much so that every resource in Azure is going to have a little button here called Diagnose and Solve Problems, specifically to help you diagnose and solve problems. And basically, this does a couple different things that I thought I'd show off that you can leverage. How many people here have used the Diagnose and Solve Problems button before? Only a few. So a lot of people go, what do I do? Best thing to do, click on the Diagnose and Solve Problems. This is now on all the most popular services. It'll be on every service in the future. We do a couple things as part of this. One is, you can immediately check to see, is there any known Azure issue affecting your resource right now? So often what we hear is, gosh, is Azure having a problem? Step one is, check here, and we'll tell you whether or not we think we're having a problem. And the way we do this is not by having some human actually push a button and actually say there is an issue. Instead, we're actually taking the raw telemetry of everything associated with this virtual machine, and we're actually looking at your VM resource telemetry as opposed to what we think is happening in the broader Azure, which means that we can be much more accurate and much more fast, because we're not trying to figure out broadly what's happening. We can just say, is this VM working? And so for VMs, we check, is the server healthy? Can you get access to your storage? Is there network traffic and availability going into this VM and out of this VM? And a bunch of other metrics that we can look at. And if none of those are happening, if those are healthy, we'll tell you. If we see that there's something wrong, we'll tell you we think it's our fault. We think there's a problem. And that helps you immediately understand at least, okay, it wasn't something I changed. But if it's green, it means probably decent chance it's your problem, in which case keep looking, which is what the next set of suggestions come into play. And so what we've tried to do here is give you then also a set of suggestions for each resource of how to solve the most common problem. So people say, hey, I can't connect to my Linux VM. This is a Linux VM. What are the common steps to go check? Step one, check to make sure that the VM booted successfully. Oftentimes people will install a driver or they'll install some software. It impacts the boot path of the VM. The VM can't boot, hence you can't connect. It's not an Azure issue, it's more the VM-specific issue. Click this little link. And for example, we'll now show you the new boot diagnostics experience, and this will show you everything that the hypervisor and the core OS saw as it was booting up. And so you can actually see if you have a bad driver or if you have something as part of your auto start that caused the VM to hang, exactly where it occurred in the boot sequence. And yeah, it's verbose, but there is a search feature. But you can at least look at this and say, oh, that service I just configured in the image, that's what's actually causing it to crash, or that's what's causing it to have problems. Ends up being very useful. Windows Server does not have a boot log, and so the cool thing is we actually show you a screenshot of the machine. And so if it's check disked or it's actually blue screened on startup, you'll at least see the stack trace of the actual image as a JPEG, which is kind of cute, except when you're crashed. But as part of that, and again, you can see here are the other seven things that we most likely recommend in terms of trying to self-fix in the order that we think make the most sense. And the goal being, if you do these seven, what we generally find is 90% of the reasons why people can't connect are usually resolved. So definitely recommend these. We're constantly updating them based on what we see in terms of support calls. And so every next month, there'll be more information and more built-in tools. And you know, increasingly, we're trying to both build the tools, but more importantly, guide you down this path, because it actually helps you fix it yourself. The other thing then is, if you do have a problem, open a support ticket. Do it in the context of the resource, because when you do that, instead of just having you open up a generic support resource, we'll actually tell you, again, we don't think there's any problem with your resource as part of this. And then once my support plan list updates. You can say, is it technical? Is it billing? Is it something with subscription management? You can tell us what resource it is, what support plan you have. And then we actually capture a whole bunch of information as part of this blade so that when the support engineer calls you, they actually have the diagnostic details for your VM. They have the history of everything that changed your VM so that when they first call you, they should be a lot more educated than if you just call them and say, I'm having a problem, because you're going to spend 5 or 10 minutes trying to list the GUID of your subscription ID and get all this information. This way, it's much more streamlined and captured, and we can help solve your problem a lot faster. So definitely recommend, if you are opening a support ticket, best to go through here. If you are a premier support customer with Microsoft, which is kind of our highest level support, please open your support tickets ideally through here, because we see a lot of premier support customers that call this premier number first. That way, again, the engineer then has to ask you all these questions to get this data. If you open it here, it will route to Premier Support, and they'll call you, and they'll have all the information on the first call, which can dramatically improve the overall experience. So, again, recommend different resources have a different set of recommendations. There's all built-in tools specific to resources. Definitely worth checking these out. They can dramatically help you quite a bit in terms of if you have an issue, to be able to get unblocked as fast as possible. So with that, I think we're over. And I think I'm getting the dirty look, which is my plane is about to leave in an hour and 42 minutes, and I need to get to the airport. It sounds like a plane just went overhead. Hopefully it's not mine. But anyway, hopefully these tips and tricks have been useful, even if you have been using Azure for a while or an Azure expert. Hopefully there's a few in there that you can take advantage of. And again, thank you for this morning. Thank you so much for this afternoon. I know there's some more sessions that are coming, so please don't leave. And I really appreciate you spending all the time with me today. And I really look forward to seeing what you build with Azure and with the cloud, and I hope you're really successful. So thanks a bunch.